You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the course for speakers to promote the idea of threefolding. Collected Works, Volume 338 in Steiner's Collected Works, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 5, entitled given in Stuttgart on February 14th, 1921 in the evening. It would be good to bring a few more formal matters now, so that we can then go back to other considerations relating to content. I indicated earlier that by placing yourself completely within the sense and being of one or another limb of the threefold social organism, you can find the proper tone for speaking. If you live into this correctly, it comes naturally. Now, on this point, I would like to present a few more things to you. But I would like to remark at the start here that when it comes to pieces of practical advice, situations can always be somewhat different than they were in this presentation, so that one can really speak about such things only as examples. It goes without saying that you might handle things one way in a certain situation and in another way in another situation. But when I imagine what might be fitting for the situations that you will face in your public speaking in the next few weeks, I find that I would first like to make you aware that having a very particular inner approach in each individual situation is of great importance for the speaker. You see, if you were to select a theme such as, let us say, quote, the great questions of the present time in relation to the threefold social organism, close quote, and if, because you had a number of speaking arrangements at various places that week, you were to present this theme by repeating at your lectures a number of specific statements that you had mastered through memorization, this would be the worst thing that you could do. For inner reasons relating to the content of the material, this is probably the worst method that one could choose for such matters. You can actually develop a responsible form of speaking that supports the content only when every speech you give is also new for you personally. Even if you give a speech 30 times in a row, or in a more extreme and seldom case, 100 times in a row, it is necessary for you to experience it as something new, even if only in the way that I will shortly describe. It is necessary to have great respect and attention for the content of that speech, to allow it to present to your soul all of its fundamental nuances, not so much its particular structure, its particular formulations, but rather its fundamental aspects, before you deliver it, to allow it to live once again in your thoughts. How you are able to approach your speech depends on the relationship that you have to the material. I have known top-notch actors and actresses who have told me with great conviction that they begin to feel as though they have played a role well only after they have played it for something like the 100th time. Now, a certain kind of illusion is naturally hidden in such a statement, for they probably had that feeling after the 94th time, and after the 50th time as well, but only in relation to the performances that came before that one. And at the most basic level, this feeling is simply what maintains the necessary feeling of freshness toward the act of speaking. That you can simply never get enough of the material you are speaking about, even if you are repeating it almost exactly. Someone who must give a speech, and who feels that it already bores him, or that the act of giving a speech bores him because he has talked about the same material so often, seems to me like someone who has eaten for a whole month, and on the first day of the next month says, I am bored with eating, because it is just a repetition of all the eating that I did for the last 30 days. I do not want to do that again. In its most basic functions, the human organism does essentially the same monotonous thing every day. At most you vary the food that you eat a little bit. You can give the same nuance to the way you think about a lecture, so that a change is brought into it much in the same way that you vary the meals you eat day after day. But basically that monotonous pairing of hungry eating, thirst drinking, and so on remains, and at the root it never seriously becomes boring. In encounters with the lively growth of the natural, even the spiritual forces present in the deteriorating world, our intellect, our whole soul life, in fact, turns away from this fact. It turns away out of a belief that to receive something once is then to, in quotes, have it completely. If you progress in soul development, then you return to things found in nature and in the original spiritual elemental forces, the rhythm, the repetition of the self. And we must participate in this particular return to everything that stands near to these original creative forces, nearer than our deteriorating intellect and our soul life, if we are to work in the spiritual world, in the sphere of the spirit. The religious denominations have already taken this up at a basic level. They do not have different prayers for every morning and every evening, but rather the same prayers. They take it as given that this is not boring, that it has the same relationship to the entire soul development of the human being as eating and drinking has to physical development. We can relate to everything that we do in the realm of the spirit, particularly in the case of something like public speaking, in such a way that we go through the content of our work with the same inner interest again and again before presenting it, even if we have already done so countless times. Only then, when we have run through the content in this way, even if only for a few minutes, only then will we achieve the proper relationship to what we want to say. We will also achieve the proper feeling of responsibility only through this method. This feeling of responsibility is something that you will need when you find yourselves in a position like the one before us in the coming weeks. You must make yourselves conscious of the fact that in your talks you are not speaking merely to the people who are present. Rather, you stand in the midst of a world historical moment, and your talks hold something of meaning for this world historical moment. You must hold up before your soul the weight and significance of what you are doing. You have to say to yourself something like, quote, I have something to bring to people that, if it strikes a chord with them, will truly serve as the only means of elevating the world, while all around us are the forces of its downfall. Close quote. If you stand in this relationship to the matter, then you will also be able to properly assess all of the opposition coming toward us from every corner of the world, shouting loudly on all sides of the path that you are now planning to tread. Within our movement, most people, including many members of our society, will pay no attention to this opposition. They do not like to worry themselves with it, and this reflects a lack of interest in history. But we must speak and do our work out of an interest in history. Only then will our words take on enough weight for us to work with them. We may not take this opposition lightly. It is actually quite horrifying sometimes to see how people within our movement remain so impassive when faced with the terrible attacks that are made on anthroposophy, on the threefold social organism, and even on the commande attaque. In this regard, the opponents are, if I might be allowed to say such a thing, a beast of a different stripe. Some of them are truly ruthless rogues, but their roguery is filled with an incredible zeal, and they find words that are motivated by a certain enthusiasm, often by the enthusiasm of wickedness, even most of the time, or even by the enthusiasm of inability, an inability that protests because it cannot come into being opposite what is being brought into reality. But there is vigor in it, to some extent. Even in their complaints, there is vigor. You do not find the right words when you just set them down with artistry, but you find the right words if you can arrive at them through your whole bearing and feelings toward the subject. This is what we must move toward, both in written and in oral practice. We should not turn away in fear from the very harsh criticisms that are shamelessly being levied against anthroposophy and the threefold social organism, and we must become conscious of the fact that the shadowy outline of something positive emerges from this experience. Also of relevance here is what we bring into our positive speeches against our opponents. The fact that we talk about these things is done with no consideration for defending ourselves. You must certainly defend yourselves sometimes. I have done it in the past. But what does a defense really mean against an individual like Max Dessoir and others like him? In an instance like this, it is very significant to point out what damage is done to German educational and university life to have such persons as instructors. Putting this general cultural phenomenon in the proper light is something for which we must find the proper nuanced words. And in that case, it is definitely a good thing to, shall we say, paint a particular picture of these things. You then have to seek in your life experiences the right shades, the right colors with which to paint this picture. There is karma to it, if you simply attend to it in the proper way. This karma will hold for you the necessary nuance. In my book titled The Riddles of the Soul, I refer to the unusual fact that Max Dessoir mentions in that thick book he has written that he is one of those people who, due to some particular bearing in his soul, has to pause sometimes in the middle of a thought, unable to go any further. This can even happen to him when he is giving a lecture. He is suddenly so filled up with the power of what he is trying to express that his mind just stops dead in its tracks. He does not say it quite this way, but it is as though this happens. I brought this up in my Riddles of the Soul. A few weeks ago I received a letter from a friend who was in one of Dessoir's courses in Berlin, during which precisely this happened, that Dessoir's mind suddenly stopped dead in its tracks. The students called this peculiar piece of university furnishing, quote, "Pretty Max," close quote, because it was a tradition of his, according to the friend that I mentioned, to put on a different colored vest each week for his lecture in class. This is nothing more than imitation, you see. Greater men than Max Dessoir have had the same sort of weaknesses. For example, it happened once to the famous philosopher Kuno Fischer that a young student went over to the barber shop that was right next door to the university buildings there in Heidelberg, and this barber was quite understandably interested in the university and the young men who attended it. And so he started to have a conversation with this crass young chap who was planning to enter the college so that he could study with Kuno Fischer. The young man confided in the barber that he wanted to study with Kuno Fischer. Quote, "He is writing on the board today," close quote, said the barber. Quote, "How do you know that?" close quote, asked the young student, astonished. Quote, "He was here just before and had me tidy his hair in the back. He always does that before he plans to write on the board. He has to turn around to do that, you see." Close quote. Now, in quotes, "Pretty Max" found himself in the situation one day where the thoughts just suddenly flew out of his head. When this happened, he started to get a little wild, and it goes without saying he was wearing his vest of the week. There was a student sitting in the front row who had a newspaper in his hand, and he went at this student, started screaming at him that it was all his fault because he was reading the newspaper that Dessoir had lost his train of thought. 5 minutes later, he picked up the thread of his thoughts again. This all really happened. It has been documented. You can easily make careful use of such things, and you will find often that you can bring in some particular colors if you want to describe the strange state of education as it is carried out at universities these days. Aside from its terrible parts, the ones that are aggravating and destructive, it also has plenty of bizarre aspects. I myself, if I may be allowed to mention it, knew a chemist who was a professor of organic chemistry and technology. Every year that he was at university, he said, quote, "Yes, there are in fact only three great chemists. The first is Liebig, the second is the more recent Gorup Besanitz, and modesty forbids me to mention the third." Close quote. Now, as I said, for us it is important that we not place emphasis on the desire to defend ourselves, which can naturally spring up in these situations. What is important for us is that we present cultural phenomena for what they are, in all their negative aspects, that we make ourselves, thereby, strong enough to arrive at a judgment of these so-called spiritual streams of the present. We can then allow this to flow into our positive presentations, and we will more effectively bring this into others' souls in this way. If we want to get through to our contemporaries, then we must be able to cultivate in their souls a feeling of repulsion towards certain present-day phenomena. We must be able to cultivate a proper judgment about the terrible things that are spreading in the world from incompetence and more especially from dishonesty. In order to be able to do this properly, we need only demand of ourselves that we keep a sharp eye on the world and not let people get away with certain things. We want to criticize the symptomatic things going on in the world, particularly in the realm of so-called science, as certain dishonesty predominates at present. And we will continue to see this. And this dishonesty, which actually only continues to grow stronger the more we move from natural scientific and philosophical faculties through medicine and into other provinces, this dishonesty is something that we must not fail to describe again and again in our presentations to our contemporaries. This is of the utmost, of an absolutely highest importance. People these days do not really have a strong feeling against what this dishonesty actually does, how corruptively it works in the feeling, thinking core when someone who is otherwise a scientist is consumed by a certain dishonesty while working. And in the long run, if not immediately, we will have already achieved a great deal if we make our contemporaries aware of the presence of this dishonesty in the educational life. We will find the proper rhetorical approach to this if we take up the kind of attitude toward the matter that I have described to you here. Particularly when you find yourself in a position like the one in which you will be during the next few weeks, one thing seems important, that you live actively within the material that you intend to present, that you actually always struggle with it to a certain extent while speaking, that you allow your preparation to be such that the intentions, thoughts, and subject come before your soul, but not the specific wording, because you must always struggle to arrive at the right words only once you are standing before the audience. Therefore, it is good not to prepare the specific wording you will use, except certain key sentences at most, depending on how you are individually. You might be the sort of person who writes down key sentences, but not mere slogans. As a rule, slogans will only lead you astray. Rather, key sentences, mostly things that will be the themes of particular sections. So you might write, for example, quote, "Economic life has its own rules. It turns everything into a commodity." Close quote. And then, since you will not take this just as a starting point, but as the theme of a section, you will talk about it in such a way that everything you say crystallizes around it. You speak to build things up around a key sentence like this. Then you transition to the next key sentence. It is really good to have only the first five or six sentences as well as the last five or six sentences of the lecture written out word for word, and not just in your memory but in your whole intellect and mind. Having the others written out is not good under any circumstances, because it significantly hampers your active inner relationship to the matter. But it is necessary to have the first and last five or six sentences formulated rather exactly. Anyone who stands before an audience as a human being and not as an oratory machine will always have stage fright during the first five or six sentences. This happens precisely because one is a human being and not a machine. So it is a good thing to get stage fright. It can take many forms. It might be that stage fright gives us inner liveliness during the first 5 or 6 sentences, which, if they are well formed, then provides us with the right inner relationship. On the other hand, if we have not formed the sentences well, it can too easily happen that something just does not occur to you, can it not? For example, I knew a man, an otherwise excellent lecturer, who always read his lectures off a sheet of paper. But one time, it is as though he is standing in front of me now, I remember this so clearly. One time he wanted to present at least the first 2 sentences, the first sentence from memory, but it did not come to him. He had grown so accustomed to having a manuscript that he had to read from the very first word on. So when it comes to the first 5 or 6 sentences, it is good to really live into them fully, down to the level of the exact words themselves. So, for such, in quotes, opportunity lectures, as the ones that you will be giving, in the best sense of the word, I mean to say that they come from the opportunity of this present moment, it is doubtless best for such talks if you bring the first 5 or 6 sentences along, already written down, then the key sentences, and then again the last 5 or 6 sentences at the end. But if I might be permitted to give you all a piece of advice, I ask you not to take this up in such a way as to think that you always have to follow it under any circumstances, and always have to do exactly what I am telling you with the piece of paper that you bring along. My advice would be, make up a sheet for yourself upon which you write down the first 5 or 6 sentences, and then the key sentences, then the last sentences. Hold yourself to that, and then burn it. Do the same thing the next day, or for the next lecture, and then burn it again. It is better to do that 50 times than be content to bring the same sheet of paper to 50 different lectures. This action belongs to the inner enlivening of the relationship between the person and the material. You must, as it were, be finished digesting the living material of the lectures that you give. It must be as digested as the food that you ate on February 13th is on February 14th. This should be considered a rule. You see, in certain areas of work, it is important that we rediscover the way back to elementary relationships to life. This is the only way we can tear spiritual work out of its moldy state, which it is in because in the life of abstract reasoning there are ideas like this. A person wants to experience something only once, and once a person has experienced something, then it no longer produces a sensation. If you get used to doing things like what I have just described, you will gradually come to a place where you can receive everything produced spiritually from far deeper places than the questionable places that are prized most highly by people thinking of external expansion. And it is enormously important that what is most exalted spiritually does not come out of this heady intellectual place. This region is colorless, it is prosaic. It is such that even if this sounds paradoxical, it actually concerns no one other than ourselves. Everything reason is able to achieve in clarity concerns only the person who bears that reason. What we have to say to the world is not based on what we understand, but rather on what we have felt our way through and experienced, on things that have caused us pain and sorrow and joy and feelings of triumph. And, my dear friends, the content of what you have to say to the world in the coming weeks, you will be able to re-experience anew every day. If you go through this content in your soul, you will feel triumph and sorrow, and in a certain sense, if you feel what shall be, also happiness, redemption. Above all else, you will be able to feel a strong sense of responsibility. All of this can be done every day, and this is a much better preparation than any other, and much better than anything you will find in most books on rhetoric. This living inner relationship to the matter is what actually truly prepares us to develop those imponderables that exist between us and our audience, no matter how large it might be. In general, it can be noted, in regard to this, just how much we have become abstract and theoretical. I once heard a lecture given by Hermann Helmholtz, at a large gathering. He took out his manuscript and read the whole lecture from the first word to the last word. Afterward, a theater director with whom I was friendly came up to me and said, quote, "What was that? The lecture has already been printed. He could have just handed a copy personally to everyone who was listening. And if Helmholtz, who was certainly very prized and honored, just went around and shook everyone's hand, that would have been a much greater pleasure than listening to something that you could just read yourself, since it is printed." Close quote. We actually need to hold this fact up before our souls. The printed word, including everything you read out in a speech that you wrote down earlier, is something entirely different from the spoken word. And even if it has already happened often, for reasons other than purely artistic reasons or something similar, that the spoken word was then written down, that this aramonic art was practiced, and then the written word was read again, we should not conceal the fact that the whole procedure is, in essence, a whole lot of monkey business. For certain reasons, this has to be done, but it is monkey business all the same. For those who take up these matters artistically, what is spoken is not the same as what can be printed or written down in the same moment. So I was deeply sympathetic when that theater director said to me that it would have been better if Helmholtz had just shaken everyone's hand and had his printed lecture passed out. These are things that must be held up before the soul, because this is what constitutes rhetoric at its most basic level. Whereas what you find in books on rhetoric are mostly the sorts of things that cannot really be filled with content. They are thickets of brush. They are dried-out straw, things that you cannot actually do anything with when you intend to live actively into the matter at hand. These are the sorts of formalities, shall we say, that present you only with recommendations. You, nevertheless, can, I do not want to say think through, you can sense and feel through and through these recommendations. And if you do this, you will be able to prepare yourself in the best possible manner for your task in the coming weeks. Out of the feelings that you will develop toward such recommendations will grow a vision of how you should actually approach the material that you will be working through in the coming weeks. And in regard to this, I want to add the following. In the kinds of talks that you will be giving, even if you grasp the themes in the way that I have just described, it is good to start with something that belongs to the current moment, with some sort of current event that is also symptomatic of this whole historical moment. We are living in a time in which such events happen every day. If you keep up with current news, even a little bit, we will notice these sorts of symptomatic events everywhere. We can use these as a starting point. By doing so, we immediately create an atmosphere of commonality between ourselves and our audience. For the audience knows about the event, we know about it, and we create a kind of communication that is of particular significance for contemporary historical talks, or, to say it a little better, for talks that are meant to have an effect on history's unfolding. Or you can describe a symptomatic event that lies a little farther afield. It is often a particularly suitable way of properly concentrating the audience's attention when you describe something that seems to have no connection whatsoever with the topic, but that has a deep inner connection with it. This makes the audience perceive a kind of paradox, not knowing why you are talking about it, and then you try to find the transition from this to the topic that you actually intend to discuss. Another recommendation is this. In certain cases, it is exceptionally good if at the end you come back to the beginning. You can do this best by formulating something at the beginning that you present as a question, not asking the question pedantically, but posing something question-like. Then the lecture becomes the exploration of the posed question, and at the end you finally come to the answer, so that the whole thing is closed in a certain way. Doing this often has a very, very positive influence on the souls of the audience. They will retain everything more easily than they otherwise would. With certain things, it can even be good to have a kind of motif that you return to after certain sections, albeit in a different form. If you formulate something in the same way every time you say it, you will not be very effective. But if you return to something in a different form, you could thereby achieve something quite good. Then we will also have to effect a kind of reforming influence on the audience through the structure of our talks. I could also say a kind of pedagogical influence, if it did not offend people to hear the word pedagogical. You can have a reforming influence through the structure of your talk. You see, people will demand of you nowadays that you define things as much as possible. But we want to limit ourselves when it comes to defining things. We do not want to make the concession. There are other concessions as well that we do not want to make, but least of all do we want to give people pedantic definitions. Instead, we want always to characterize things. Indeed, we want to characterize some things from two or more sides, in order to bring forth a sense of how any particular thing can be characterized from multiple sides. We have to put forward the impression that everything that comes from a spiritual foundation, everything that stems from spiritual science, must come forward also in a different form before our contemporaries than what comes out of materialism. Everything that comes out of materialism will be materialistic, even if it is saturated with apparent religiosity, even if it is colored by the religious. It will speak in hardened, fixed nouns. What comes out of the spirit cannot speak very well in these hardened nouns. For the spirit does not work in that way. It is in constant motion. Spirit is necessarily comprised of action words, of verbs. It dissolves the noun form. It prefers to form clauses rather than making use of fixed nouns. In this way, it avoids treating beings like pieces of wood. It avoids placing them next to each other like pieces of wood or stakes. Placing things next to each other like stakes, that is materialistic. What is grasped in the spirit dissolves the hardened noun. And it is important that we not make any concessions in this regard to our materialistic time. In any case, this will probably not be the case for you. It is much more likely to happen to contemporary poets, not so much to people who say the kinds of things that you have to say. In any case, when something emerges from the visionary realms, it can also come in the form of these hardened nouns. But there, the imaginations are figures. Every style has its own particular character for its own particular area. But what is needed in a certain sense is to bring something new to your fellow human beings as teachings, as insights. This, if it comes out of the spirit, will never feel compelled to merely line up hardened nouns side by side. Then it will be good for you, I would like to suggest, to really go through something moralistic. When we were beginning our anthroposophical movement, people were proudly saying, quote, "When I was somewhere or another, I presented theosophical or anthroposophical insights without saying where they came from and without using the word theosophy or anthroposophy," close quote. This denial of the ground upon which you stand has become a true nuisance in anthroposophical circles, this desire to disavow oneself of the matter at hand. Now, I would like to say to you that the people who have been won over because someone avoided speaking about the matter clearly and openly have either not truly been won over, or if they have, then the victory is worthless. The only things that have any value for our movement are ones that have been achieved with complete truthfulness and absolute honesty. And if we make that a clear guideline, then perhaps we will suffer a loss here or there, and wherever we do achieve something, it will be a good victory. Under no circumstances should we avoid holding up the spiritual, scientific, and anthroposophical foundations of our work to people, even if, for a large number of people, this is like waving a red flag in front of a bull. The trouble is not the red flag, it is the bull. These are the things that must belong to the moral nuances of our zeal on behalf of the movement in the coming weeks. And we need true zeal. We do not need to have the feeling that we are to be martyrs for something, but we should have a feeling of great responsibility. We should have the feeling that we are speaking out of an evolutionary and historic moment, The more we feel this, the better. I could remind you again today of something that I have said often in the past. I wanted some time ago to make clear to two Catholic clergymen how unjustified they were in the particular demand that they made of me after a lecture. I had given a lecture in a southern German city, which is today no longer a southern German city, about the wisdom of Christianity. Two Catholic priests were present at the lecture. It was during the period of time, a long time ago now, in which the demand to fight intensively against anthroposophy had not yet gotten as far within Catholic circles as it has today. After the lecture, they came up to me. Now, it is true, is it not, that when it comes to anthroposophical matters, one can speak objectively about a theme for a long time, even if Catholic priests are in the audience. If they have not been told beforehand that they should dispute everything that has not been constitutionally sounded out by the Church, they would not notice that there was anything to complain about. The opposition coming from the Church must come from places other than truthful ones. So the priests came up to me and said, quote, "Well, we have nothing to say against the content of your lecture," close quote. At that time, the cry from Rome had not yet gone out, quote, "But the way in which you speak is no good, for we speak in such a way that everyone understands us, but you speak only for a particular circle of people who are already prepared," close quote. I always have the feeling that one is not dishonest in external life if one speaks to people in a way that is customary in external life. I address every Hofrat as Hofrat, court counselor, and address every Catholic priest as Your Reverence. So I said, quote, "Your Reverence, it is not a matter of whether you or I think that something is for everyone. It goes without saying that you and I think that subjectively. This is not the point. Rather, it is a matter of whether or not something is carried out from the impulses of the moment, whether, regardless of our subjective understanding, it should be brought forward or not. And so I ask you now, since I am presupposing this good subjective knowledge, whether all people who want to know something about Christ come to your church these days? If all of the people come to your church, then you do indeed speak for all people. So, totally objectively, I ask you, do all people come to your church?" Close quote. They could not say yes. It was not true. Then I said, quote, "Now, you see, those who do not come to you in church anymore, but still want to hear something about the Christ, I am speaking to them. That is objective. We can believe subjectively that you and I speak for everyone. That is not important. What matters is that we resolve to learn from the facts about how we are to do so." Close quote. Of course, the two priests did not really take this in, but it is true all the same. So those are the things, largely formalities, that I still wanted to say to you. They are not rules, nor are they recommendations meant dogmatically. I said at the beginning of my remarks that they are meant more as examples. They can be altered in many ways. It might be that you will find yourself in a position where it is necessary to follow other guidelines. But I was just thinking about what those of you who are sitting before me might have to consider, finding yourselves in the position that you might be in during the coming weeks. One of you in one way, another with a different nuance, depending on how you carry it out, in order to step before the public in the proper way. Above all, in order to place yourself in the right relationship to what is to be accomplished, either completely or not, how you should relate to the things that you must present. And this is how I arrived at needing to tell you about the sort of formal things that I have just discussed. The end of Lecture 5.